Okay, thanks a lot. So welcome everyone officially, and welcome Scott. Thanks a lot for agreeing to give the talk. So Scott is a staff astronomer at NRAO in Charlottesville, Virginia, and also professor there at the University of Virginia, and a founding member of the NanoGraph facility. And so we'll hear about some exciting new developments from him today. So please, Scott, take it away from here.
Great. So thanks, and apologies for being late. We actually are having a NanoGraph collaboration meeting right now via Zoom, and during it's all obviously completely virtual and stuff. And literally about 20 minutes ago, more like a half hour ago, the postdoc coordinator was like, "Scott, the next moderator just dropped out of the and can't hook up, doesn't have internet right now. Can you moderate the next session?" And I wasn't even thinking. I was like, sure, I can moderate the next section. I'll step in and help everyone out. And then at 1 o'clock, I was like, oh my God, I'm supposed to be with Perimeter. Anyways, sorry about that. So anyways, NanoGraph. So what I'm gonna be talking about today is how the NanoGraph collaboration, we really think we are moving substantially closer to detection of nanohertz frequency gravitational waves. And a lot of this is based on the work that the collaboration has put out in the last month or so, maybe slightly more than a month now, maybe a month and a half, with our 12 and a half year data releases, as well as the gravitational wave stochastic background searches that we've done on that 12 and a half year data release. So since I think probably most of you are quite familiar with what we do, I'm going to go very quickly through the background stuff, because I'd rather have a short talk and then have you guys ask some questions. Especially since I also have to leave at 2, I have to be gone by 2 so I can get back to the other meeting where I am supposed to moderate the next session as well. So let's get going. So NanoGraph is a growing collaboration. We're about 15 years old now, maybe not quite that old, 13 years old, I guess. And we now have well over 100 students and scientists that are actually part of the collaboration, from a wide variety of institutes, not just in the US, but Canada is very well represented, as well as a handful of people from other countries around the world. And I should just mention that we have a very open policy for membership, that if you're interested in working with us on something, we encourage people to apply for associate memberships. You can go to nanograph.org and look at our governance tab, and there's a way to easily start working with us and get access to data early and come to our working groups, et cetera. So I encourage you to do that if you're interested. And a lot of the details about how NanoGraph works can be found in the US Decadal Survey for the Astronomy Decadal Survey white papers that came out this past year. And in last year in July, the program white paper, or the project white paper, that kind of describes how we're structured, what our kind of big strategic type plans are, was put on the archive. And you can see that I'm the first author, but it's came out on the archive, and all of those project white papers are also available on the National Academy of Sciences Astro 2020 website. So I encourage you to take a look at that as well if you're interested in more details about us, as well as our website. And also, I'm going to very briefly mention that this isn't just about NanoGraph. There are two other pulsar timing arrays that are working in around the world. One of them is the so-called Parkes pulsar timing array that uses the Parkes telescope in Australia, and the other is the European pulsar timing array using an array, a variety of telescopes in Europe. And together we work, we're joining our data, dealing with a bunch of astropolitics and egos and everything else that involves collaborations with several hundreds of people, together in what's known as the International Pulsar Timing Array. And what I suspect is that you're going to see is over the next few years, the IPTA is going to be becoming more and more important in these types of studies. So basically, the main sources that we're looking for are nanohertz frequency gravitational waves from supermassive black hole binaries in the centers of galaxies that will merge in tens to hundreds of thousands of years. And those pre-merge, well, the galaxies have merged, but the black holes are pre-merger. We expect that these systems are throughout the whole universe, and we're sensitive, at least for the really, really massive binaries, out to Z over 10, Z more than 10. So basically the whole universe is visible to us in these nanohertz frequency gravitational waves. And the way you can think about the experiment is we have an array of pulsars So there's dozens of pulsars around the sky that we're timing very precisely. And you can think of those as one end of like the interferometer arms of LIGO or Virgo, and the Earth is the other end of the interferometer arms. And because we're timing the pulsars, we can measure the relative changes in the length of each of those arms very precisely, down to hundreds of meters or even tens of meters for each pulsar baseline. And then over the course of years, because these supermassive black hole binaries are pumping out gravitational waves, the Earth is effectively riding on the sea of gravitational waves, jiggling us towards and away from, in a quadrupolar fashion, of course, each of these pulsars. And we see then correlated, spatially correlated, timing residuals that are due to the motion of the Earth in these gravitational waves. We also could potentially see the jiggling of the pulsars as well, so the other side of those arms. But right now, we can't use that information, because in order to really use that information, you have to know the location of each of the pulsars to within a small fraction of the gravitational wavelength. We have to know their distances to that. And right now, there's only like one pulsar that we know to sub-parsec precision distance-wise. So right now, it's purely the so-called Earth term. And the jiggling of the pulsars due to the gravitational waves is an extra noise term for us. And I've mentioned nanohertz frequencies multiple times. We're on the very low end of the gravitational wave spectrum, where LISA in the next two decades will be in the millihertz frequencies, and LIGO and Virgo, which you know a lot about, are in the tens to hundreds of hertz frequencies, is going right now. And then at the ultra, ultra low frequencies, we have the imprinted gravitational wave spectrum in the CMB as well. But the interesting thing you can see here, where there's characteristic strain on the y-axis, we think we have a roughly power law spectrum of astrophysical sources that are due primarily to black hole binaries. And the ones that we're looking at, as I said, are the most massive of these binaries due to galactic collisions and mergers. And we're talking 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar mass black hole binaries. The one thing that I will mention on this plot, which a lot of people don't appreciate, is you can see our noise curves here, the way things are shaped. Whenever we give a limit or whatever, it's based on this low point here in the noise curve. But the cool thing is, as we observe more in time, we get a square root of T improvement and square root of N improvement just in the amount of data. So we move down, straight down. But the other thing that's cool is that as we time, our baseline of timing increases. So this trough, our most sensitive spot, moves to the left as well, which is great because our sources are also brighter at those lower frequencies. So as we move down and to the left, we're moving up as well in the kind of the brightness, the gravitational wave brightness of our sources. So our sensitivity, once we're in the regime of detecting gravitational waves, improves quite rapidly. And that's a really important point. So this is based on pulsar timing. I usually give a big spiel about this. I'm not going to here just for the sake of time. Those of you, you've probably seen pulsar timing before. The crucial bit is just this top line at the, I've lost my cursor, there it is. At the top of the slide, we unambiguously account for every rotation of a pulsar over many years and durations. And for the best millisecond pulsars, we can do this to sub 100 nanosecond precision now over decades, which is really extraordinary. And that literally is the delta T over T. That's exactly like for LIGO, the delta L over L that we measure the gravitational wave strain with. So that delta T of order 10 to 100 nanoseconds over, say, 15 years of time, that's our gravitational, very roughly, our gravitational wave strain sensitivity. We use data primarily from the Arecibo and Green Bank telescopes. You can see that our currently we have about 39 pulsars with Arecibo, about 39 with Green Bank. We're timing a handful with a very large array kind of experimentally. And over the last couple of years, we've started using CHIME for all of the pulsars that are far enough to the north that we can see, and that they're basically observed daily then. And we haven't actually used any of the CHIME data yet with our analyses, but that's coming probably in the next 1 to 2 years after we get we really need like 3 years of good timing before we can really use it, add it to the array. But that daily observing at those lower frequencies are going to be really great for letting us remove the interstellar medium, which is one of the dominant noise sources for our data. And one thing that's really important is that Arecibo and Green Bank are both really crucial for us, even though they're both very different telescopes. Arecibo has about 4 or 5 times the sensitivity over Green Bank, but a much smaller sky coverage. In this sky map, the hashed region are the regions of the sky that Arecibo can see. So if there's a pulsar in that region, we're going to use Arecibo on it because its sensitivity, and just so you know, we're basically sensitivity limited on all of our pulsars. So if Arecibo can see a pulsar, we use it because it gives us much better timing. But the problem is it's got a small sky coverage. So that 3 times improvement in sky coverage of the GBT lets us get all these other millisecond pulsars that we wouldn't otherwise get. And since we're looking for spatial correlations over the whole sky, combining these two things together is really important. And it turns out that each of our telescopes provides roughly about 50% of our gravitational wave sensitivity. And because both of our telescopes have been under financial strain, and there's been threats of closing and stuff, we're still always very worried about losing our telescopes. We've had multiple data releases over the past decade. Our first data release, and I love this plot because it really shows how things have grown and improved. So starting from the lower right corner, the y-axis is the year, basically, and each column is a pulsar. And the different colors are the different observing frequencies that that we use. And we need multiple frequencies to remove interstellar medium effects. But this bottom right, you can see that where we started in 2013, that's the so-called 5-year data set. We dramatically improved that for our 9-year data set that came out in 2015. The data that I'm going to show you, I'm going to very quickly touch on the results from a couple of years ago, was our 11-year data set that came out in 2017. And then the data that we just released is the so-called 12.5-year data set, which is this next largest rectangle. But the cool thing is that 12.5-year data set doesn't even go up to the start of 2018. So we still have almost 3 years of data in the bank already that we're working on right now for our next data release, which is going to be tentatively called the 15-year data release that we will have out this year sometime. So everything I tell you is like about the release that we have so far. The cool thing is, you know, it's not like we have to wait many years. We already have data in hand to make the next step forward in our gravitational wave searches. So for the 11-year results, just very briefly, just to remind people what we saw or didn't see. So here's a plot of our posteriors for a stochastic gravitational wave background based on our 11-year data. And what we would like to see in this plot is a big peak at some part of this log AGWB, which is the amplitude of the gravitational wave background. So we'd like to see a big peak showing that we've isolated, we see gravitational waves. Well, you can see in these dashed lines with the faint lines, there is some peaking there, but to the low log amplitudes, everything trails off. And that means basically that we can't rule out this part of the probability space. And a very rough Bayesian ratio of the Bayes factor that you would favor gravitational waves over not gravitational waves is basically where the peak divided by this level. If you have the right model, obviously. Well, it turns out that if we assume that we know the JPL solar system ephemerides perfectly, it turns out that's not the right model. It turns out there's a bunch of errors in our solar system ephemerides. And we've been working very hugely on how to handle those errors. And those errors translate into uncertainties, slowly varying uncertainties in the solar system barycenter at the tens to 100 meter level. And if you think about it, those are exactly the timing precisions that we get with, you know, hundreds of nanoseconds of precision. And we reference all of those to the solar system barycenter. So knowing exactly where all the planets are, and especially the sun, is really, really crucial in these observations. And it turns out JPL's ephemerides are not quite doing it for us. So the what we've done is we figured out a really nice Bayesian way to marginalize over the errors and the ephemerides. And these are different versions of the solar system ephemerides. And that gives us a consistent result. And so basically we had an upper limit, which is basically here, where we can say that gravitational wave background must be less than a certain level. And there's a beautiful paper on this by Michele Vallisneri et al. And a big chunk of the NanoGrav team, as well as some of the JPL ephemerides people, that's been published this year, which really, really shows really nice stuff. The important messages from this, though, this lower plot kind of shows this. That is, this is really important to take the stuff into account when we only had 11 years of data, which is shorter than the orbit of Jupiter, which dominates the errors. But now that we have 15 years of data, basically, the importance of marginalizing over these errors becomes less and less with time. And we're able to disentangle this orange line rising here, lets us disentangle a gravitational wave background over the systematics of the solar system in a much better way. So this becomes a easier problem to handle as we have more and more time in our timing baselines. So that's really good.
But as a function of frequency, does this uncertainty only, you know, manifest, you know, at the frequencies of the planet's orbits?
Yeah, although they perturb the even outer planets as well. And there's several second order type effects where the planets are perturbing each other. But the dominant effects are Jupiter and then Saturn. But because if you just think about the resolution, the frequency resolution we have, you know, when we only have 15 years of data, our frequency resolution is 1/15 years. So that there's a big slop in that, in our kind of frequency resolution capability, which is why the orbital periods of Jupiter and Saturn still matter to us. And but they slowly decouple as we get beyond their orbital periods. So it's not like there's a sharp delta function at right at Jupiter and Saturn's orbit.
I see.
Yeah.
Just because like the baseline is like, you know, like the baseline is similar to Jupiter's period. Yep. I see.
Yeah. So there's various covariances, both in the way we time, the various things we're fitting, the solar wind. There's a whole bunch of things that are also have these similar time scales, and there's a lot of covariances, but they all break once you get a few years past the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn, especially. Mm-hmm. And the other big thing that improves is that Jupiter, we actually knew Saturn's orbit better than Jupiter's because of the Cassini mission. But Jupiter had not had a big orbiter and for a long time, but it now has the Juno mission that's been there for a couple of years. And that Juno data, the ranging on the Juno spacecraft, has dramatically improved the orbital information about Jupiter. So all these things are really helping us, and we don't think that solar system ephemerides are going to be an issue for us effectively anymore, at least not at a strong level like they were in the 11-year data set. So with the 11-year data, we were able to make some astrophysics implications. It disfavored having the most massive black holes. Like if you looked at the black hole galaxy bulge relation, there's some questions about how that's normalized, what the y-intercept is and what the slopes are. Our values didn't like the most massive black holes in that because we would have seen gravitational waves. It also kind of showed us that, you know, if we weren't seeing a ton of gravitational waves at these very lowest frequencies, there might be some type of environmental effects such as extrastellar density or eccentricity of those binaries or lots of gas in the centers of galaxies that would cause turnovers in the spectra of the galaxies. But this was all very preliminary. So I'm not gonna spend any more time on that right now. But the coolest part was that finally, we were able to start saying some things about astrophysics with our gravitational wave limits. And we were already able to start ruling out like the most optimistic models like the McWilliams et al. 2014 model, which is completely gravitational wave driven massive black hole binaries. Nothing else affects them, basically. And so that's a good place to be. It means that, you know, we're in starting to get an interesting part of phase space of when we might see some things. In the meantime, though, we have this fantastic pulsar timing data that we can do a ton of other stuff with. So we've been doing that both with our 11-year data and our 12.5-year data. So there's a paper that's going to come out very, very soon on these incredibly detailed studies of the interstellar medium, showing how the dispersion measure changes dramatically. There's these yearly terms, and there's all sorts of interesting oscillations and stuff where we get really incredibly detailed information on the interstellar medium. We're able to make incredible limits about what planets there might be around Nanograv millisecond pulsars. As you, most of you might know, some of the first extrasolar planets were found around a millisecond pulsar. But since that time, there's only been like one or two other planets found around pulsars. And like, where are they? You know, why did we find them around one of the very first millisecond pulsars, but we haven't seen them since? And they certainly do not exist around Nanograv millisecond pulsars down to moon masses. And this was work by then undergraduate Erica Behrens and the rest of Nanograv. It's really, really nice. Neutron star masses. This is my ex-PhD student who's now an Einstein fellow at Cornell, thankful Cromarty. This 2.14 solar mass neutron star that we measured with Shapiro delay, which is one of our Nanograv millisecond pulsars. And that really constrains the high density equation of state. So these types, I think that might be my only, that's my only other example. But, and we've had a ton of other papers come out as well with interesting astrophysical type things we can do with our pulsar timing data. So that's one of the nice things, is that even though we're waiting for gravitational waves and having to be very patient and time all these pulsars, we get a whole bunch of other really nice science out in the meantime. So the exciting new stuff is the 12.5 year data release. And here is the from our submitted and actually just as of last week accepted data papers. We have two of them. We have two different, slightly different ways of how we're timing these the pulsars, and we have a paper on each. But the data sets are the same in both. And lots of pulsars with Arecibo and Green Bank. And the longest timing baselines is 12.5 years. And to show roughly how the gravitational wave strain sensitivity changes from the 11-year data set to the 12.5-year data set, this is from a really nice modeling paper by Jeff Hasboon and his collaborators. And basically, you can see this is a log-log plot. So this 11-year sensitivity line compared to the 12.5-year sensitivity line is a substantial improvement. And you can also see how we're moving down into the left, exactly as I mentioned, and riding up that curve of where we expect to see these the black hole binaries as sources for our gravitational waves. So it's really, even though it sounds like an incremental improvement, that 1.5 years of data, it makes a substantial difference in the analysis of our gravitational waves. And the cool thing is we are seeing, well, we hope it's cool. It could be a real problem, but we are seeing significant low frequency noise in our data. And what I mean by this, we're calling this a common red noise process. And it's common in that we're seeing red noise with similar spectral index of its red noise amongst many of our pulsars. So it's common across the data set. It's not spatially correlated. And that would be the thing that we would need to see. It would need to be spatially correlated in a nearly quadrupolar manner, the so-called Hellings and Downs curve, for us to say that we're seeing gravitational waves. We are not seeing that right now. We're just seeing this common red noise process. And if we take a look at the data averaged over all of our pulsars and kind of compute a pseudo power spectrum and look at the lowest frequency bins, you can see this excess noise here and here in the two lowest frequency bins of the data set. And then the white noise starts dominating at the higher frequencies. And we've had to change the way that we are analyzing our data set. We used to do power law fits to the first 30 frequencies. And you can see if we do that now with this green line, just because there's so much of this, you're getting so many of these white noise dominated portions of the spectrum up here, it downweights this incredibly significant lowest frequency bin. And that's exactly where we would expect to start seeing gravitational waves in our data set. So what we've done is we've changed to a much smaller number of frequencies in our analysis, and we're fitting broken power laws or just single steep spectrum power laws to our lowest few frequency bins in order to capture this, this information. And when we do that and look at how these fits in terms of spectral index, they are consistent with what we would expect from supermassive black hole binaries, which is a really great thing. But that is, you know, that's a nice indicator. It is no way at all definitive that that's what we're seeing in our data set.
When you say, when you say common, you know, like what does that mean exactly? Like, you know, these fluctuations are not in phase with each other, are they?
No, because that would depend on where the pulsars are.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But, okay. Yeah. So it'd be like you're seeing power with these very low frequencies. So, you know, of order the lowest frequency bin. So of order 12 and a half year periods, we're seeing power at those frequencies in each of our, well, not each, but a big chunk of our pulsars, but they're not necessarily in phase.
Okay. Yeah. So it's just in the autocorrelations of each pulsar, not exactly the right. correlations.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So then so then the most simple explanation, I guess, for that, this is that each pulsar has some intrinsic noise in its timing.
Yep. That is absolutely a possibility. The models that we have of spin noise and pulsars in general suggest so this is what we expect from gravitational waves. We expect something substantially steeper, which is completely consistent with the data. Matter of fact, I would argue that would be favored for the data here for a spin noise type explanation. The thing is that spin noise has been very, very hard to track down and measure and even make any kind of physical modeling of. And so that is a possibility. But the big thing, I think, is if it's going to be a spin noise, if it's going to be due to intrinsic noise in each of the pulsars, there should absolutely not in the next year or two or three be any kind of spatial correlations. But you're exactly right. That is, right now, it is a completely acceptable explanation for what we're seeing in our data.
And so how significant is the detection of this, you know, autocorrelation?
It's huge. 30,000 to one base factor. I can't remember the exact number. If you assume this Bayes FM, this Bayes FM thing, as I said, is becoming less and less important with time. You can see the difference in the posteriors between using the absolute newest, including the Juno data around Jupiter, solar system ephemeris compared to Bayes FM. They're not dramatically different here, which is great. But if we assume the fixed tilt solar system ephemeris, which JPL says right now is substantially better than what we had before. So if that's the case, then we're 30,000 to one in favor, roughly, of this uncorrelated common red noise process. So it is very significant.
Right. Okay. So therefore, go ahead, Luis.
No, this was on the previous slide. So I wanted to understand what you meant by saying, if you assume this is a signal that comes from binary black holes and is consistent with the expectations, but then the uncorrelation. So how do you reconcile this one claim with the observation?
Wait, I'm confused. Reconcile which claim?
So you're saying that, so on the right plot, you claim that this is consistent with gravitational waves coming from supermassive binary black holes, right?
Yeah, I would say that would be consistent with, yes.
But just to follow up on that, I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
It's also consistent with spin noise, right? It's also consistent with
I understand, but if it were gravitational waves, you would see correlation on the behavior of different pulsars, and then you don't see that, right? And
so that's
then,
right, yes.
So I'm trying to understand how you can say it is consistent with a population of binary black holes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
even though the other observation still is there.
So here's the simple answer. And it was also already mentioned, basically it's this autocorrelations versus cross correlations. And I don't think I have a really good slide. Well, I kind of do. So let me roughly explain it, and then I'll walk through the next two slides as well. Basically, the majority of the signal that we would see from gravitational waves, the majority of the power of that signal is still in the autocorrelations. It's just that the way to definitively show that you have gravitational waves is seeing the so-called Hellings and Downs curve. And that is a much smaller effect, but almost purely, but not exclusively, almost purely in the cross correlations. So what I can tell you right now, so let me summarize that again. If we're seeing gravitational waves, we should be seeing a strong autocorrelated signal of red noise and weak but present cross correlations that cause the Hellings and Downs curve. We are not seeing a Hellings and Downs curve right now. We see no significant cross correlations that represent gravitational waves. But if we have gravitational waves at an amplitude of roughly 2 × 10⁻¹⁵ in the strain spectrum, we would be seeing autocorrelations like this. That's what I'm telling you.
So how much stronger, you know, do we expect in the Hellings and Downs curve, the autocorrelation at theta equals zero to be than the cross correlation at theta of 90?
So let me jump ahead here. So you're asking basically with the Hellings and Downs type curves.
Yeah, that's right. So at zeta equals zero, for example, how much stronger should it be compared to these other zetas?
Let me think about the right way to say that. It's the total amount of correlation that you expect to see, because we're only seeing the Earth term and not the pulsar terms, is at most, it's 50% is the cross correlation at zero, compared to the zero crossings at, you know, whatever, I can't remember the exact, and this is a little bit offset. This is the monopole. So the zero crossing is, you know, happening at 48 degrees or something. And the minimum is not at 90, it's at 70-ish. For the Hellings and Downs.
Well, there's no spike, I guess, at zero, right? You know, there's no delta function.
Right.
That function is smooth. So if you're seeing like 5 sigma or something at zero,
I think they're not showing zero. I mean, there should be a spike at zero because of the pulsar's own correlation with itself.
That's right. But the, you know, I mean, that's
but
right.
We don't have any pulsars at zero except for the pulsar itself.
Well, yeah,
the literally that's at zero, right? So that's, our closest separation of millisecond pulsars is degrees. So that's why this bin can't go down to zero. We don't have anything at the really, really small separations, but we do have things that are at quite small separations. And so we have lots of data points, that let us like fill in at least the low, separation portion of the Hellings and Downs curve.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the noise that you're seeing at zero, that noise was like 5 sigma or something we were saying, right? You know, 30,000 Bayes factor. Okay. Yeah. Whereas at non-zero separations, you know, you're seeing like 1 sigma or 0 sigma or something. So therefore then is the timing noise therefore like 5 times bigger than, you know, than the signal? I mean, right. Like, I guess my question, you know, is, you know, does your detection just mean that the timing noise is huge compared to the expected signal?
It depends on what you mean by the expected signal. If you're talking about these plots, the Hellings and Downs type plots,
right,
which are hugely based on just the cross correlation terms,
right,
especially when you do this frequentist so-called optimal statistic, which is only the cross correlations. Yes, what we're seeing right now is much stronger than that. But if this is gravitational waves, those autocorrelations are still part of the gravitational waves. It's just that, I think this might've been what Luce was saying, you know, how can you say it's consistent with it if you can't show that it's not something else? I guess my point is the other way around, saying if we see gravitational waves, we will see a much stronger autocorrelation signal than we do the cross correlations in the Hellings and Downs. So this is, I guess what I'm saying is that this, if this is what we've been looking for, if this is gravitational waves, and it's a big if, this is exactly how we should start detecting things. We would see it in the autocorrelations first. It would get to become very strong in the autocorrelations. And then as it's at the base, you know, depending on if you're talking signal noise of 5 or, you know, base factors of tens of thousands, whatever, at roughly that level, the cross correlations start to become significant. And we should start seeing some things start creeping up in the Hellings and Downs. So let me get to that part right now. This is what it looks like in the 12.5-year data set. And if I should, I wish I had another. There's a really nice slide that was just given yesterday in the talks in the NanoGrav meeting, which I would like to be able to show you, but it's one of the figure three, I think, in the NanoGrav gravitational wave paper that shows how we're going through this decision tree. Is there a common red noise process in our data? And we're doing Bayesian model selection step by step. You know, are there Helling-Znan correlations? Are there monopole correlations? What we can say is yes, there's this common red noise process. But when we try to say the next step, are there Helling-Znan correlations? The answer is no, they're not significant right now. They're base factors of like 10 or something. So they are not significant right now.
Can I ask, sorry to interrupt?
Yep, go ahead.
So the normalization of the Helling-Znan curve is absolute, right? So you don't fit for that.
It's only absolute if you know that you mean in terms of correlation?
Right.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
Right. But the monopole is something you fit for.
Yes, but we can put, like, for instance, we have normalized here because you can do this effectively in terms of what kind of gravitational wave signal would you see that's going to affect like the size of your error bar. So in this case, it's not absolute in that you're not seeing correlation of 50% at the peak. This has got this A squared in here. So there is a way to parameterize this in terms of kind of signal to noise ratio that includes the amplitude of the gravitational wave background. And so that's what we're seeing here. So we're effectively fitting for, based on this A squared, the amplitude of the Helling-Znan, but we know its shape. And we're fitting where would these data points sit for a monopole as well. And you can see it's not at zero, which is interesting. So our best fit is not at zero, but if you look at the confidence regions, it's consistent with zero. This is not strongly, it's not strongly not zero, so to speak.
Okay, and the way to interpret the monopole is that this might be timing noise from individual pulsars. Is that what I'm supposed to?
Well, because this is that's a monopole signal correlated over our pulsars. So that what that could be, the example we always give in pulsar timing of a monopolar signal that you might see would be if our atomic clock systems, if the atomic timescales are drifting at 10 to 20 year timescales at a level of, you know, nanoseconds or tens of nanoseconds, it would cause a monopole signal like this.
Okay.
So right. It's something that would affect all of our pulsars. Yeah.
Right. Because the timing noise from each one is not correlated though.
Right.
So you don't.
That's exactly
that.
Right.
Okay. Yep, thanks.
Right. Yep. All right. I basically showed that. So here's where we are here. So right now, we cannot, there's no way right now we can say what type of noise, what type of red noise we have in our data. But the nice thing, and this is my whole point, this is exactly what we would see on the stages to detecting gravitational waves, which is a cautiously hopeful thing for us. In
NanoGrav. But it seems surprising, you know, isn't it, to see at, to see the autocorrelation at like 5 sigma, 30,000 significance, but then to not see then like the other cross correlations at some similar significance, right? You know,
well, yeah, let me,
like your blue curve doesn't have a delta function at zero, right? So
yeah, that's, we have no zero terms. You know, this is literally not plotting the autocorrelation.
Yeah, that's right.
This analysis. Yeah, I mean, this analysis does not include the autocorrelations. So it's impossible to see that in this plot.
Right, you know, but if the signal seen in the autocorrelations had been due to, you know, astrophysical gravitational waves, mm-hmm. you know, then at the 5 sigma, 30,000 level that you're seeing, shouldn't you then have seen a significant cross-correlation signal?
No, not at all. And that's exactly what I mean. Because the autocorrelations are so much stronger for a gravitational wave signal that the cross correlations come in a little bit later in time. And
okay.
I'll jump forward. So there's this paper just came on the archive this week by Nihon Po. We submitted it to Nature Astronomy. And it basically shows as a function of time, if you take the autocorrelations that we see and say, what would the gravitational wave background be that would provide autocorrelations of that level? We're somewhere in this part of the plot. So we'd be moving like somewhere right in here. We are now roughly here. And so the total overall signal to noise that we're seeing gravitational waves, including the autocorrelations, would be something like 3 now. And it rises very, very quickly. But the thing is, those cross correlations are much, much lower. And it's the cross correlations that will make everyone or anyone believe that we're seeing gravitational waves. But the cool thing is, as this total signal to noise ramps up, the cross correlations become, and the Helling's and Downs curve become significant quite rapidly. And this paper and others have shown that once you start seeing a strong autocorrelation signal, within the next 1 or 2 or 3 years, it improves so fast that you will go from basically a signal to noise of 1, which is this is of order signal to noise 1, the 12.5 year data set. The Bayes factor, like I said, if we look in the paper, the Bayes factor for this Helling's and Downs curve is something like 10. Compared to, say, monopole and dipole. But if we take just a couple more years of data, and if what we are seeing is gravitational waves, this becomes much more significant in just the next year or two, which is cool. So things at this cusp, things improve very, very rapidly. So that's why we're cautiously optimistic.
Is it fair to say that the ratio of signal to noise for a quadrupole to the intrinsic noise is like 1 to 4? Is that the right number? So basically, if you see at 4 sigma, the noise, the common noise, then you see this advanced sigma, the quadrupole advanced.
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't heard it said that way, but that's probably within a factor of 2 of being correct. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. probably right. Especially since these optimal, so-called optimal statistic frequentist way of doing this, these Helling's and Downs searches, they literally are just the cross correlations. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think, yeah, a factor of 1 to 4, maybe even 1 to 6 or something like that, I think is about right. But I haven't thought of it that way, so I don't know what the exact number is.
I think that would clarify things, because of course, I mean, 30,000 is a big number, but factor of 4 is not that, like, I mean, 4 sigma is a huge detection, or 5 sigma, but 1 sigma is not. So.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And that's why we're not claiming gravitational waves. You're exactly right. That's totally correct. Mm-hmm. But we are claiming common red noise in our data, right?
Yeah. And it makes a factor of 4, I mean, going from kind of a monopole to quadrupole, or I guess monopole is not the right word, but zero lag noise to quadrupole, it could go down by a factor of 4.
Right.
So I don't think that's very surprising. Okay, right. Thanks.
Yep.
Okay. So that blue Helling's and Downs curve you're saying would have a delta function at 0, whose amplitude is like 4 times bigger than
in
this smooth part. Okay.
Yep, that's correct. Yep. And there are other types of analyses that we've done that do include the autocorrelation terms. It's just not the ones that this particular analysis that produces a Helling's and Downs where you're actually averaging true correlations among the pulsars is a frequentist type thing where the autocorrelations are not taken into account. But when we do the Bayesian model selection, which we've done that as well, which includes the autocorrelations, it's still not significant yet. For the Helling's and Downs. The autocorrelations are themselves, but there's not enough of the cross-correlation terms in the Bayesian analysis to have it favor a Helling's and Downs model over any other type of correlated model. Does that make sense?
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks so much.
Yep. So you've probably seen there's been a bunch of papers on the archive, though, about, you know, all sorts of crazy physics that we might be seeing. Hell, some of you may have written some of those papers, so I'll just go on past that. This was the best thing, though, is to have XKCD talk about it on the day that we actually released the results. I mean, the guy is pretty impressive at how fast he does his work. But this is the kind of the cool thing. This paper, as I said, by Paul et al. And the rest of the NanoGraph collaboration was on the archive this week, and shows how we expect, given what we know of the noise properties of the pulsars and the data set as a whole right now, we can predict forward into the future as to how things are going to play out. And the cool thing, as I said, is that we just published basically something roughly here, but we have data here already right now. So that's pretty neat. And that's this 15-year data set, which doesn't even go to 2020 in this plot, but a lot more pulsars, which is very important, because when you're in this weak signal regime, or I should say intermediate signal regime, where the signal to noise is of order one, the sensitivity for the stochastic background scales most strongly with the number of pulsars. And you, the way to think about that is in the Hellings and Downs curve, you just want to get as many pairs of pulsars to make spatial correlation measurements as you can, because you're measuring the cross terms. So the number of pulsars is hugely important in that whole effect. And so the fact that we have dramatically increased our number of pulsars over the last decade has been a real goal of NanoGrav, and we're really happy that it's worked out. And we're going to push that into the future. We think that over the next decade, right now we're timing something like 80 millisecond pulsars. We think using the current generation and potentially the next one more generation of telescope, that future pulsar timing arrays, say a decade in the future, might be able to time about 200 millisecond pulsars in our galaxy. And having all of those pulsar timing baselines, since it goes as the square of the number of millisecond pulsars, really gets you beautiful measurements of the nanohertz frequency gravitational waves. So while we're right now just starting to move into this, we think, you know, a decade from now, we're going to be making like beautiful shapes of the gravitational wave spectrum, and potentially even have individual detections, potentially multiple individual detections by the end of the decade. And this is all kind of assuming, once again, that these autocorrelations that we're seeing now are the first step in seeing gravitational waves. If what we are seeing is spin noise of pulsars, then it's not game over. What this does is it pushes all this potential science in the future, it pushes it off by another 3 to 5 years, because the gravitational waves still are going to cause Hellings and Downs style correlations, which eventually win out as long as we have enough pulsars over the individual timing noise. So as I said, no matter how you slice it, we're ramping up beautifully right now. So even if the current signal is pulsar timing noise, which we don't actually think it is, but if it is, we're still going to be able to do this type of thing within the next 5 to 10 years. So that's pretty exciting. And we're still making a bunch of other improvements. We have the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation has just given us two grants to build ultra wideband receivers at both Arecibo and the GBT. And these greatly help us remove the interstellar medium effects. The only bad thing, this is my last slide, is that the Arecibo, as you know, was damaged, and currently we're not getting any data from Arecibo. And we do not know the timescale for repairs, but the National Science Foundation seems to be committed to repairing it, but it could be 6 months to a year. If it's much longer than that, that will actually start affecting our long-term sensitivity. But if we lose of order 6 months of data, it's a minor blip on our sensitivity predictions from the future. But it's still something that we're very, very much worried about. Basically, that's the summary. We're cautiously optimistic, but there's also a big, you know, a ton of worry that what we're seeing is some other kind of systematic, kind of like what the solar system ephemeris was doing in our 11-year data set that we haven't figured out yet. But we have a ton of data in the bank right now, and we're going to figure that out very, very soon, within the next year. So you're going to be hearing a lot more from us soon.
Thank you. So okay. Scott, I had a very simple question. So suppose, maybe you already said this, but I ended up jotting some calculations here, trying to answer this question, but you probably already did the following. Just doing injection on a whole bunch of pulsars and maybe set up in a distribution like the one you're seeing, assuming it is gravitational waves, and asking what would it take to have this autocorrelation be this large and yet not show anything in the Hellings and Downs curve?
We've done that. And that's exactly, that is exactly the way that we predict things will go. Matter of fact, if we go back to this slide, so this paper discusses this a little bit, this new poll et al. One that just came out. But this other paper by Hasboon et al. That is a way of parameterizing our sensitivity. It also discusses this in that, you know, seeing this is exactly what we should see. I just want to stress that point. We should see strong autocorrelations first, where we won't see cross correlations. But then if we keep doing things, the autocorrelations continue to grow and the cross correlations merge from the noise. So once again, this is kind of what I was saying. This is totally consistent with what we expect.
That's assuming a particular distribution of binaries, or
it's assuming 13 thirds, the spectral index of spiraling galaxies at 13 thirds. So no matter what level of amplitude, as we push down, we're going to see autocorrelations first, and then a couple of years later, see cross correlations. No matter what, as long as the mergers are being dominated by gravitational waves. That is the key assumption.
Thank you. And my second question, maybe it's a quick one. So what role would chime pulsars play? You're saying that you're still not using them, but how are you going to use them in the future?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll use this slide as an example. So in order to measure the arrival time precision of the pulsars to sub microsecond, we have to remove the dispersive effects of the interstellar medium to at least that level as well. And the dispersive effects of the interstellar medium are frequency dependent. So we need to have large frequency baselines, but there's a whole bunch of issues that come along with this. There's scattering, which causes scintillation, and pulse broadening, which is highly frequency dependent. And the pulse shapes themselves, intrinsic to the pulsar, change as a function of frequency. So all of these frequency dependent effects we have to somehow measure and remove in order to get our 100 nanosecond timing data. And all of those measurements have to be done with wide frequency bands. And the beauty of Chime is that it has a factor of 2 frequency coverage, an octave frequency coverage at lower frequencies where all of these effects are stronger. And it's measuring all of our pulsars every single day. So the real beauty of this is that we get measurements every single day to help remove the interstellar medium effects so that we can correct our data to get the absolute timing to sub microsecond or 100 nanoseconds where we need it for the gravitational waves, because that's not frequency dependent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. And okay, let me just check, just real quick, I want to check, make sure, I think we might have a break, or I got to make sure I'm not supposed to be moderating at 3.
Right.
Two.
Yeah, you mentioned you need to go in a
couple
minutes.
It's 2:40. Okay, so we actually have we're okay.
So we have time for we can talk a few more questions.
Although I do have another meeting I have to go to within. I am so overbooked. It's ridiculous. I could talk for like maybe 5 more minutes. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So then we have a question by Eric. I think he was first.
Right. So can you just say the data sets from the other two collaborations, how did they compare? Or are they getting close to doing something similar to what you just did?
Yeah, so it's an excellent question. And it's one that we're discussing in our NanoGrav meeting right now. And we're also discussing it hugely amongst the IPTA as a whole. And as you can guess, there's a ton of politics about this, astropolitics. So it's a complicated question. It's not super easy to answer. Within the last 3 months, there have been 2 papers that have come out with the Parkes team that have released what they call their data release 2. Their data release 2 has substantially fewer pulsars than we have, but they have a handful of pulsars with which they've timed exquisitely well. And they have a timing baseline that is even a couple years longer than ours. They have fewer pulsars, which in a detection is a really important thing, but they have a longer timing baseline, which really helps with the detection. And they have a couple excellent pulsars. So that's the Parkes team. They have not yet published their gravitational wave analysis. They're working on that. The European team, they have more telescopes, but each telescope is less sensitive than either the GBT or Arecibo. They have a substantially longer timing baseline on a handful of pulsars out to something that they have 15 or 16 or even 17 years of data for some of their pulsars now. But the number of pulsars which they've timed really well is much smaller. They have something like between 6 to 12 pulsars. Matter of fact, they had a paper come out this past year where they published a subset of what their next data release is going to be. And it had, I think, 6 pulsars in it, which they were working on to make gravitational wave limits. You absolutely cannot make a detection with just 6 pulsars. But they have other pulsars which are timed with less precision that they haven't published yet. These nanograph results have stimulated a huge amount of work amongst the other PTAs. And we're now trying to negotiate how to get within literally the next year, how to get all 3 PTAs to publish new data sets and hopefully different analyses on each of our data sets for gravitational waves. It's not fully agreed yet, but that's the plan. And then meanwhile, we're going to get subsets of our people to try to join all of our data together. But the data combination is truthfully a very, very difficult process. So the joint IPTA data sets are always delayed by 2 or 3 years compared to each of the individual PTAs, just because of it's a huge amount of detail-oriented work, and combining with from different telescopes and different methodologies makes it way harder.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we have a question by Will.
Hello. Thanks for the nice talk. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about this issue of pulsar timing noise. Like, are there any theoretical predictions for what causes it, or at what levels it should be, or are there any like example pulsars where people have some independent measurement that allow you to get sort of a handle on this?
Yeah, so it's been studied since the earliest days of pulsars, but mostly in the context of young pulsars, which show a lot of it, or even normal pulsars like that Jocelyn Bell found, the slow pulsars, because those also show substantially more noise than the recycled pulsars that we're measuring. A handful of the millisecond pulsars show strong timing noise. Matter of fact, one of the very first millisecond pulsar ever found has strong timing noise. And if you look at the nanograph data set, you can see massive cubics in the data. And that's certainly timing noise. The trouble is the studies for the timing noise for the younger and slower pulsars do not predict well to the millisecond pulsars. And matter of fact, 10 years ago, when all the PTAs were really starting to really get going, no one had any clue whether we were going to be able to get 100 nanosecond timing precision over decades because of timing noise. The predictions were that we would see more of it than what we see, and we see very little. Out of our pulsars with the 12.5-year data set, there's something like 60-some pulsars in our 12.5-year data set. We definitively see some level of timing noise in something like 8 or 10 of those pulsars. So at the 15 or 20% level, the others are not showing timing noise yet. But because it's a steep spectrum process and we don't know the exact spectral index, we think it's steeper than gravitational waves, but that's uncertain. But eventually that will kick in to become a big noise process. But there's been a bunch of studies on it that they just don't predict well for millisecond pulsars. So we're really at the cutting edge of that right now. And if that's what we're seeing, like I said, that's going to inform a lot of the physical models of what causes timing noise, but it's not going to stop us from detecting gravitational waves in the next few years. So.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, do we have any maybe very quick final question? Okay, well, if not, then maybe we should let Scott go and give him at least a few minutes of a break. Thanks so much again for giving a great talk today. Yeah,
taking the it was time. A great talk. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. And sorry I was late. I screwed up.
No worries at all.
All right.
You're going to have to pay with an hour talk in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We should invite you back in like a year or two from now.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd be happy to do that. All right, take care, everyone, and stay safe.
Take care. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And bye, everyone. See you next week.